You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome to the Here District, the Fantastic Voyage. This is the captain of this vessel, Captain Marcus Johnson, and my first mate, Chris Johnson. What's up, Chris?
What's good, brother?
I like that. You're rocking the 414. That's Brandon Jennings, right?
All day, every day. Tough crowd.
Yeah, tough crowd. Bucks and six. All right. Yeah. For those that don't know, we had been asked, myself, Pat Connaughton, Brooke Lopez, Brandon Jennings, quite a few of us, Chris Middleton, to design our own version of our caps that we would like to see out there in the public sphere. And so, mine was a little corny. I had a picture of myself dunking on the side of it was a pain.
That was interesting.
Yeah, George Pollard, I think, was the artist's name back in the 80s, in the 70s, actually, my rookie year. Did a great painting, and I was able to put that on my cap. So all good. Listen, so, I'm watching these game sevens. Let's talk about that first, man. Watching these game sevens, Chris, and I get this flashback to my days with the Milwaukee Bucks, right? Because game sevens are so special. I had the privilege and the pleasure and the honor to be a part of three game sevens. Now, my rookie year against Denver, I'm not, going to count that one because we were just as a team feeling our way around. That was my first experience. But my next one, 1979-80 against the Seattle Sonics, right? We had them down 3-2 at home, lost the game. I think I had 30-plus points. Mm. We lost the game, so it didn't matter. And so we got to go back to Seattle for game seven. And I can remember, Chris, feeling like we were the better team. They were the defending NBA champions. We had picked up Bob Lanier at the All-Star break and went like 20-6 from that point on, and we were rolling, and we were full of ourselves.
Right.
Now, the one caveat that I will throw out there is that our guy who would have been sixth man of the year, if there was an award back that year, I'm not sure if there was, but Junior Bridgman hurt his foot early in that series, only played one or two games, and he was averaging 18 points a game that season. But my point is that I came out, Chris, cool. Came out real cool. Our guy back in the day was Dr. J, and it was always trying to be like people were trying to be like Kobe, like Mike, or whatever. We were trying to be like Dr. Okay. like Ron. We were trying to be cool, real cool. And the Sonics, having been to the finals two straight years, Johnny Johnson, Gus Williams, Dennis Johnson, Lonnie Shelton, Jack Sigma, a former Buck later in his career, they understood. They understood what you had to bring in game seven. We didn't really have a good feeling for that. And so even though we were up, Chris, we were up like with about 2 minutes left. We're up 3-5 points. We have the game right in our reach. Yes. Please, questions, please.
But no, seriously, but what's the difference? I mean, you knew what to do for three games. You got three wins. Why is it in game seven, all of a sudden you forgot everything that you were doing the games one through six?
Well, I was cool games 1-6, but you had but cool. It took more than.
Why weren't you cool game seven? But what, I was cool. What about game seven?
I was too cool game seven. I was cool games 1-6. Game
but
seven.
Why?
Is
a, but game why? Seven is a whole, why? I'm trying to figure game, out why.
Game seven is a different animal, and that's my point. Watching these game sevens recently between the Knicks and the Pacers and then the T-Wolves and the Nuggets. It's different. It's different. The game sevens are just it's a different level of energy, And playoffs are as a whole, every possession is magnified and all that good stuff. But game sevens is a different animal. And my point is that the Sonics haven't had the experience of going to the NBA Finals 2 years in a row. Lost 1 year, I think they may have gotten swept by the Bullets. I forget how that went. But I think they may have lost in a game six or seven. Dennis Johnson had a terrible game, 0-14, came back the next year, had a great series, and they beat the Washington Bullets. But my point is that when I was watching, it just brought back memories. I didn't watch that Sonic game seven, Chris, for about 40 years. It was about maybe 2 or 3 years ago that I watched to really see what went on in that game, because I was so disappointed because I knew we were the better team. Had them down 3-2 at home, blew it. Went back to Seattle, had them down by 5 with about 2 minutes left. And didn't. But then I look at the game, Chris, and I realize that, coolness was a factor, but also just, it's hard to articulate exactly, but we didn't play through our best player. Let me put it that way. It was kind of this equal opportunity offense, and we had guys
can't do that.
We had guys taking shots down the stretch that should have been passing the ball
can't
to me.
Can't do that in playoffs, man.
I'm open a couple of times, and we had some guys forcing some shots. I'm watching that game, and it brought back those memories, but that's what it is.
But, M, here's my thing about that. Like, I get your point. Having been there, Seattle 2 years before, the experience, you know, of game, you know, being able to handle game seven. But you made it just sound like the focus shifted from who the bread and butter was offensively until equal opportunity offense. Now, I don't think that has to, for me personally, that's not like some nerves of the game situation. Now, when you look at Denver and Minnesota, you got Minnesota, a team young and experienced. Sure, they've been losing, but they have not been to the heights. To me, it seems like Minnesota is Milwaukee. Denver's like the Seattle in this story, right? So how come Minnesota was able to overcome whatever game seven jitters that they had and get the W against Denver?
But it's not even the jitters. I'm telling you, it was the opposite of jitters. It was just not taking the game, just not putting the requisite amount of energy right from the start. It's like, I know we better than this team, Gus, DJ, yeah, whatever. We gonna win this game. We're gonna find a way to win. We've been winning, you know, since we picked up Bob Lanier. We got this swagger, but they had more than the swagger. They had this attitude of understanding that it's diving after loose balls, that it's second and third and fourth efforts. I remember blocking Johnny Johnson's shot not once but twice, and he got it back a third time and scored. You know, and I thought I did my job blocking his shots twice in a row, but he stayed with the play. It's just little things like that when I looked on it, that they had that knowledge of what it took in terms of how hard you had to play every possession. And to your point, the Pacers reminded me of kind of where the Bucks were, the Knicks. Not that they were the established team, but they were the favorite. The Pacers went into on the road, you know, and all my game sevens were on the road. And the Pacers went into Madison Square Garden and played harder, played more desperation, played more sense of urgency basketball, sure, and played better, and just played better to 1 through 8. Everybody that got on that floor, Isaiah Jackson to Andrew Nimhard, every T.J. McConnell, you know, outside of what the main guys were doing, they just played like you're supposed to play in a game seven. So anyway, just brought back those memories, man, and it was just fun to watch. Now, my third game seven, I learned my lesson a couple of years later. We played against the Sixers. You know, we lost that one in Philly, but I had like 36 and 12 and had this great game because, you know, I came out there like balling with this sense of urgency and purpose, and they just beat us. They were the better team that day. But it's just interesting the things you learn about yourself in game seven situations like that and the mental aspect of it all. Now, this is Mental Health Awareness Month. And I want to thank everybody out there who responded to our last podcast. We talked a lot about that. We shared a lot about things that we've been through individually and collectively, you and I. And the response, man, were you surprised at all? Or what was your response to the response?
Yeah, it's always surprising when you do stuff or say or talk about something that you're genuinely just talking about from a standpoint of, you know, you and I were engaged in the conversation, and then people are hitting us up like, yo, man, we appreciate that. You know, I appreciate people for getting something out of it. It kind of opens my eyes to how powerful, you know, our just talking about or sharing our experience can be, the effect that a shared experience has. I think that was the biggest thing that I noticed. I mean, when we getting hit up on Twitter from, you know, Rex Chapman and Lisa chimed in and all kind of people, just it makes you feel really good, you know, because it's kind of a nerve-wracking situation, Em, you know, when you record it, you don't know how it's really going to be taken, you know, out there, you know. I don't know if we said too much. I don't know if we went too deep, but you know, when you get that type of response, it makes it all the worth the while.
Yeah, and I talked about the disappointment and processing the loss of a game seven and how that stayed with me, and so Mental Health Awareness Week and month, in terms of athletes, professional athletes. I mean, that's a kind of a newer field of study. Maybe I should put it that way, but we're going to have a guest on who is really, really an expert in this field, does an outstanding job, Craig Manning, Dr. Craig Manning with the Milwaukee Bucks. And he's going to join us in a bit, but I'm just really looking forward to having a discussion with him, because I wish, my point is, I wish we would have had someone like that on staff, you know, helping us to navigate through those major disappointments, but also those successes and everything in between. And we didn't have that. We had to kind of fend for ourselves and rely on each other. And that was okay, only to a point, but we didn't have the professional background, you know what I mean, to really understand the inner workings of the mind and different motivational techniques and all that good stuff that goes into you know, good, strong, solid mental health. So I'm looking forward to that. So that's a good thing also. What else we got Absolutely. On the table, man? What else are we talking about here?
Did you hear what JJ Redick said about Doc? I mean, so JJ and Doc have been kind of having a war of words in the media for a long time. JJ talked about Doc's coaching, you know, the trends and just how, you know, Doc, you know, ultimately is going to throw his team under the bus and not going to take the blame.
The trend is always making excuses. Get Doc. We get it. Taking over a team in the middle of the season is hard. It's hard. We get it. Just like getting traded in the middle of the season is hard for a player. We get it. Mm-hmm. But it's always an excuse. It's always throwing your team under the bus. They lose to Memphis. Oh, it's his players. Memphis was playing G League guys and two-way guys. And then you look at his quotes over the weekend. Now he wants to take credit for the James Harden trade to the Clippers working out. He wants credit for that. There's just no, there's never accountability with that guy.
So Doc had finally responded.
But if you make decisions that the player doesn't agree with, and in JJ's case, we didn't sign him back. You know, with the Clippers, I stopped playing him as much because he wasn't very effective in the playoffs. And, you know, that's all known. But I'm fine with that. Like, usually they all come back to you. Mm-hmm. They do. Because they know everything you tried to teach them or do for them was in good. J.J. Redick's best numbers of his career was under one coach, and you're looking at him right here. Mm-hmm. I'm the one that grabbed him out of Milwaukee and decided to start him. From that point on, his career took off.
What do you think about Redick going after Doc and just, you know, the war of the words? Hey, have you ever gotten into it with a guy like that with two NBA? Like, what's the NBA beef all about, man? What's up with that? Egos or what?
Yeah, well, and then it was funny. Austin Rivers kind of, you know, sprang into action defending his pops too. And then
I'm shocked.
He took some clap back from James. Who was that? Jamal? Who was that? Who was the Jones wide receiver? What was that guy's name? We talked about it.
James Jones was talking about the football stuff for the James Jones, former Packer.
But he talked about it. Remember Austin Rivers, his daddy is the only reason why, blah, blah,
for
blah.
Sure.
I mean, it opened a whole can of worms. But not, you know, what do I think about it? I don't like it. It's funny, you know, and we'll broach this subject at another time, but you and I discussed it briefly yesterday, just talking, and I just don't like this old head, new head type battle that's going on. I just read something about JJ talked about the plumbers and the garbage men.
He's been outspoken.
Yeah, but Bob Cousy said, well, you know, I got plumbers. I'm going against like Jerry West and Elgin Baylor and Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell. He just listed all these greats from his era, John Havlicek, and so we'll talk about it more. But it seems like we're the only sport, man. I got to do a little bit more research, man, but we're the only sport, basketball, where we have all this craziness going on between like the past generation and the current generation. Now look, the current generation, in their defense, I know a lot of old school guys really, really get on the style of play, too many three pointers. I can't tell you how many times there's a steal in the game right now, and a guy, instead of going in for a dunk or fan out and shoot a three-point shot. But that's, you know, getting up volume threes. We talk about that all the time. So guys don't really understand that concept. You want to get up as many threes as you can. That's house money you're playing with, a steal or turnover, a situation like that. So to the new school guys' defense, I mean, there is a lot of criticism of today's game, how it's played, the number of three-point shots, but that's the fact that I work with the Milwaukee Bucks, Chris, coming up on 10 years now, has given me a totally different vantage point in terms of how hard these guys work to improve their skill level. And not only just the Bucks. I mean, every time the defense makes an advance, the offense does something to counteract that. And it just becomes this chicken and egg game between the two that is fascinating to watch how these skills, now it's just being able to knock down deep three-pointers off the dribble, you know, pull up threes. Right. Now before that was a shot you wanted to give up. Now you can't give that shot. Sure. Guys are so proficient, and you don't get proficient as I always say, falling out of bed one day saying, oh, I'm gonna shoot a pull-up three. That's hard work. That's sweat. That's toil. That's diligence in the summertime, mm-hmm. Working on your skills, working on your craft. And these guys do it. So I have a lot of respect from that standpoint.
No, I have a lot of respect for these guys too. And I don't think the issue is like rooted it's more like the young generation looks at who your generation and before were playing against, the size of the league, the training methods. Like, they take all this stuff into account when they form their opinion and they try to discount you guys. I mean, this concept that guys were drinking beer and smoking cigarettes in the 80s of halftime, or this idea of smoking in the dugout in baseball during that era, it just totally discounts like all of your athletic achievements for this generation. Like, and I'm not saying that that's their whole argument, but it's kind of like getting at the gist of it. It's like, wait a second, you guys were doing X, Y, and Z, and you expect me to think and hold you like in regard as one of the greatest of all time when you're, you know, Michael Jordan, known fact, you know, just flu game, quote unquote, like the cat's out the bag on how you guys used to get down back then. And there's a lot of lack of respect for that. I'm just telling you, this is how they feel.
But how many stories have we heard about Michael Jordan, you know, Atlantic City all night long, no sleep? Mark Jackson just told a story recently, no sleep the next day, come out and get 50 in the garden. So, yeah, if he had got some sleep, maybe he'll score 75. So maybe he was shortchanging himself. I'm just saying, but you can't. Everybody has got to find their own kind of pressure release. And guys do it nowadays. It just comes in a different, you know, different shape. You know, and maybe it's not as, you know, as debilitating physically as doing drugs and drinking and doing all the smoking cigarettes and all that. But, you know.
But there's also an argument for the style of play and the emphasis on play and how you guys played the game and how lack of skill. So when you watch, you know, YouTube videos and you're watching guys back then, and then you watch, you know, a role player right now, he's doing between the legs, step back, stuff that they didn't see you guys do. And so there's a perception that somehow you guys were not the more skilled generation.
That's true in any sport. You can look at the golfers of the 1940s and 1950s compared to today with the advance in equipment. You can look at tennis players and the wooden rackets compared to the graphite and all the great stuff they have now that increases the speed of the ball by 50 miles an hour, whatever it is. I mean, you can look at football players in terms of, you know, conditioning and medical science and what they've come up with in terms of understanding body mass and developing skill and speed and all. It's all, I mean, my point is that if you dominated your generation of players, of the competition available to you, you were a great player, hands down. And if you were given with that baseline, that you're the best Jesse Owens, if you're the best sprinter, you know, in the 1936 Olympics, and you could some kind of way in a time machine bring all that into this current age with all the training available, he would still be one of the best.
Well, track is different, Em, because track is like times. They'll stand the test of time. So track is a little different for me. Like, sure, the evolution of runners and distance running has gotten better over the years, but there are certain records like Bob Beamon's long jump record or Mike Powell's long jump record that Mike Powell broke. I don't think anybody's ever going to break that Mike Powell record for the long jump. I don't think anybody's ever going to break the high jump record. There's like certain marks athletically I don't think will ever be broken despite what era they were set.
Yeah, well, it's all great food for thought, food for conversation. So we'll talk more about that. But I want to give a quick shout out before we take a break and get back to talking about Mental Health Awareness Month and how it pertains to sports with Dr. Craig Manning. But before we take a quick break, I want to shout out a guy, Chris, I'm writing a book with, Charlie Rosen, great author. Wrote a book with Phil Jackson called More Than a Game. Great book. Wrote a book with Ray Scott, the first African-American coach in the NBA to win the Coach of the Year in the 1970s, called The NBA in Black and White. Wrote a book about the Sugar Richardson. He's going through some health challenges, and Charlie's 83 years old. We're working on a book together called The Crenshaw Chronicles, and it kind of gets into why Crenshaw has such an iconic reputation internationally. We've already talked to guys like Daryl Strawberry and Ellis Valentine and Big John Williams and some other people who are really major, major players in terms of professional sports and academia and the music industry, great jazz artists. Okay. Donald Vega. I just turned you on to piano player who went to Crenshaw. So we're writing a book together. Charlie's under the weather, going through some health challenges. Want to give him a shout out and just make sure I do that because he's been really good to work with, and I'm learning a lot of things I didn't know. So, but that's all for the first segment of the Here District here. But when we come back, we've got Dr. Craig Manning. We're going to talk more about mental health as it pertains to the NBA sports in particular. And man, we had a great first segment. I think this segment's going to be even better. Here District, right back.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
All right, welcome back to the Here District. And Chris, man, I'm really, really excited about this next guest of ours. And I've been trying to get him in some way, shape, form, or fashion to talk about what he does with the Milwaukee Bucks the last couple of years. But the Bucks like to keep everything close to the vest. They don't like to give away state secrets. But we're not going to pry any of those out of him today. But he's going to give us some great insights, I'm sure, to what he does to help these guys play their best, be their best, be the best version of themselves. We've got Dr. Craig Manning, who is the Director of Mental Performance. And Doc, welcome to the Here District, man. Great having you.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. And thanks for having me. It's good to chat with you guys.
All right. So Director of Mental Performance, that says a lot. Let me let you explain exactly what it is that is your role with this basketball team.
Yeah, so very much. There's basically three areas of psychology. There's the mental illness side, the mental health, and the mental performance. And that's my area of responsibility within the Bucks. I was just in Chicago for the combine there, where we interview these young, hopeful basketball players, trying to get inside their head and see what we think their potential is down the road. And then once we get them to the Bucks, my education is, I got my PhD in applied sports psych, but under Dr. Keith Henschen, who was with the Jazz for 36 years, and specifically with neuroplasticity is my area of emphasis, which means the brain is always learning and always developing. If you're deliberate with it, there's no end to how much growth an individual can sustain if you engage in some of these mental skills training that we do. And that's my responsibility, work with the players directly, one-on-ones. We do team sessions and kind of all things mental performance.
Well, you said something interesting. So you were down in Chicago at the NBA Combine. And so what exactly, how do you measure whether a guy is self-motivated, is going to need motivation, a guy you want to stay away from? I mean, what are some of the signs, both good and bad, when you're looking at guys like that?
Yeah, and I'll summarize it really quick right off the bat, what we're looking for. And this is, obviously we're human beings and dynamic, but looking for confident humility is the two biggest words, if you want to put it down to two words. And there's a lot of science behind that. But we get to interview them and try to get inside their heads and figure out their routines, their trajectory in life, and go back to when they're young and what their upbringing was and how they got to this place and where we think they could be in the future. And we've done a lot of research through the years that we can pretty much identify which patterns lead to success. And there's two big inventories that I have licensure that I'm able to use. One is called the competitive styles. So we're definitely wanting to unpack how competitive they are, but then the learning styles is the other one, how good of a learner they are, but also what type of learner they are, because everybody's a little bit different. Those are the two biggest inventories we use and really gives us a lot of data on the individual.
But can you measure competitiveness through testing, a written test, or is it an observational thing? Is it a combination of both? Is it a discussion that you have with the prospective player?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. We observe them in workouts. We get them to take these two inventories that are really big, that spit out all this data that breaks it down in incredible detail. And the key is to interpret the data and figure out the pattern. And yes, so that's what we really break down. And then I love at the combine meeting them face to face, because you pick up some of the small nonverbal communications and the non-obvious indicators when you see them in person. So, yeah.
Dr. Manning, how different, and I'm going to stay on the combine here because I watched it, I scouted it, and I had a lot of interest. How different is it when you're talking to and evaluating a combine athlete versus, say, someone that's been in the NBA 1 or 2 years, like a young NBA player? Is there much difference between the two?
You know, it's interesting. It's a good question, Chris. We really feel like there is this window of operation of these athletes have their best window. I feel like sometimes they jump a little early, and if they stayed in college another year and developed, that window would be better for them. But then if you stay too long, you miss that window. So, yes, to answer your question, sometimes a one or two, first or second year guy has kind of missed that window and may have the skills and the ability to impact it, but you got to make the most of that opportunity. You guys know what the NBA is like. It's pretty cutthroat. And if you don't time it right, you kind of miss that window when a team and an organization puts a lot of money and resources into your development. And if you miss that, you're just trying your best to play catch up then. So I'd say there's quite a few second, third year players that are out there that are probably really good, but they kind of miss that window and they're not probably going to get that opportunity. So you got to really make sure you're ready when you go so that when you do get your chance, you make the most of that opportunity, especially if you're a like second rounder.
Absolutely.
So Doc, you know, when I played with the Bucks back in the early 80s, we had a great trainer who came over from the New York Cosmos soccer team. He coached Pele was one of his guys, or he was a trainer when Pele was there. And one of the biggest compliments that he gave me was that he thought myself and Pele were the two most well-conditioned athletes he'd ever been around. But what he did before the playoffs one year, I had to slide that in there really quickly. You see how I did that. But one of the great things, but he measured our body fat. He was the first guy to measure body fat. I think I was like between 3% and 4%. Had all these cutting edge at the time techniques that are probably archaic to you right now. But one of the things he did, Doc, is that he sat me in a room with a big blue screen, and he intercut positive things, especially free throws, making jump shots that I would do. Then he would go back to the blue screen. Then he'd show me doing something else positive, then back to the blue screen. And his thing was like, you know, if you're ever feeling some stress or strain when you're on the floor in a playoff pressurized situation, think blue. Think about that blue screen, and that would automatically connect you with something positive that you did. Now, that was back in the early 80s. When did your particular brand of wellness for these players, when did that become a thing? When was there a watershed moment where there was a necessity for what you do more so than any other time?
Man, it's such a good question, Marcus. Like for me, I was a tennis player and I was trying to play on the tour. I'd been selected on an Australian team and I was on the tour and I would just get in my head and spiral. And what you're talking about there, I'd get in a reactive state of mind and spiral. And I didn't know how dangerous that was and what it was doing in my career. And so I ended up going into psychology and figuring this out. And I got to tell you, for years, like 10 years probably, no, for probably 5 years, I'd turn up and speak on this topic and people wouldn't pay me a cent. But I'd sell like a case of books and a case of journal, two cases of journals every time I'd go. But lately, probably a few years before the pandemic, it was really starting to get attention and just blow up now. Like now there's so much demand for the mental performance, the application and unlocking skills and really applying it. And whoever it was there that taught you that, there's some really good stuff he was doing. I don't know if it was completely intentional, but there's really two parts of the brain, the amygdala and the hippocampus. And what the amygdala is where fear is housed. With hippocampus is where the playing to win is housed. And they're two opposite parts of the brain. And he was getting you in the right part state of mind to really play your best. So he knew what he was doing. He was doing a good job there. And they are opposites. And when any of us get in a reactive state of mind, we trigger fight or flight. We are burning mental energy and you're going to burn out.
You know, and so bringing it current. So I remember last season, not this season, when we lost to the Miami Heat. And Giannis was asked a question about failure. You didn't win a championship. Is that failure?
Yeah, remember that. Yeah.
And his response, you know, created a little bit of controversy. No such thing as failure. I forget the exact words, but it was all about process.
It's not a failure. It's steps to success. There's always steps to it. You know, Michael Jordan played 15 years, won 6 championships. The other 9 years was a failure. That's what you're telling me. I'm asking you a question. Yes or no? Okay, exactly. So why are you asking me that question? It's a wrong question. There's no failure in sports. You know, there's good days, bad days. Some days you are able to be successful, some days you're not. And that's what sports about. You don't always win.
And my point is, Doc, I felt like I was hearing some of the fruits of the work that's been put in with the current player, not just Giannis, but current players, about how you look at what you do in terms of your craft. If you could speak on that, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah, we really work hard, or at least I do, is to make sure these athletes have a strong identity in who they are as human beings, so that their performance isn't so dependent on their identity, that the performance is something they want, not something of who they are always. And one of the biggest things that Giannis was talking about there, the opposite, and most people don't know this, but the opposite of fear is learning. Mm. And so stop judging yourself, and we call it every dot moment in your life. Stop judging yourself and your performance on every single moment, and just always continually learn who you are, which is meaning knowing your strengths and what works for you, and learning from your environment. If you have that mentality, there is no fear. There is no learning. Every opportunity is just another opportunity to learn and grow and get better. And if you have that mentality, you become fearless and you can unlock your potential. And like Giannis did in 2021, score 50 points in the closeout game. He was in such a good place to unlock all of his talents all in one moment there. So he knows what he's talking about there. He's always stay in a learning mentality. That's the opposite of fear.
So, but even with the great success of scoring 50 points, game 6 against the Phoenix Suns, one of the greatest moments of my life, watching him do that, is there as much of a need for you to assist with a guy on that kind of a high as there is with a guy who maybe just, you know, did not perform up to his standards? Or do you just let it roll because he did so great?
Yeah, somebody like Giannis has worked extensively for years on his mental skills, and he is very, very strong mentally, very intelligent, just the amount of knowledge he has. But what happens with somebody like Giannis is, even though he's got this extensive mental toughness that he's worked on, he's under so much pressure all the time because he's not just a great basketball player. He's this international, you know, almost celebrity out there. So the cognitive load on somebody like Giannis, on all of us, but the absolute load because of the world we live in with social media and technology and mobile media, it's not the same as when Jordan played. There's so much load on the mind. It leads to burnout. And so somebody like Giannis needs to continually work on organizing his mind. The more organized his mind is, the more he can unlock his talent and really perform his best. But that organization is critical to handle the load he's always under. And so the mind is not stagnant. You just always want to stay in a learning mentality, always, which he does, and always work hard to organize your brain. One more comment. It's like, I feel like it's like the Formula One cars or NASCAR. It's a lot of work to get your car in that window of operation. It's the same mentally. It's a lot of work to get your brain in that window where you can really unlock all your talents. Because, I mean, I know he's a physical specimen, but all of us just aren't that good when we're in a reactive state of mind. None of us are really that competent when we're in a bad place. You know, it takes work to get ourselves in the right place to really be good at what we do.
What's the key to getting into a zone? I mean, a zone like what? Is that what you call it? Is just getting into that zone?
Yeah, zone, flow state, I would call it. The biggest thing is, if I'm using the screen, is helping them to really know who they are and have this huge, we call it conscious competence, like really be aware of our strengths and our skills. And only then can you know what you want, which is what gets you in that flow state where they call it the modern day superpower when you get in a flow state, because you're able to process information so efficiently and effectively and to be able to focus and do things that we can all do it if we get in this mindset. But to me, those are the two steps, like really knowing who you are. We call it being unapologetically yourself, knowing who you are so you can know what you need to focus on, because the game is played so quickly now, you know. And I think we've talked about this before, but if you go back when I was playing tennis, it's like looks like it's slow motion compared to how it's played now. And I think basketball's kind of the same. You've got to have your mind organized so you can unlock these skills in a millisecond. There's not enough time out there.
Dr. Manning, what are the most common challenges that a professional basketball player, a professional athlete has to face in today's game?
Yeah, three words: money, fame, and power. Those are the three, proven by science. Bill George wrote a book on this, but that is definitely true with athletics too, is money, fame, and power. Because when you start to have money and you make money and your contract's coming up, and then the fame, which is social media, which is so rampant today compared to how it used to be, but that fame is a massive distraction too. And then the power, All three of those are extrinsic motivators, and they're all outcomes. And that's one of the hardest things for me, because when they start focusing on results, they're not focused on the process. Their anxiety goes through the roof, and we're just dealing with a lot of fallout mentally from that when they get distracted by any one or all three of those. Staying humble and staying a learner and staying focused on the process is a lot of work. And that's why I see to be a legend, like to have not just to make it to the NBA, but to perform at high levels for extended periods of time, the humility part is key. And hence, that's the confident humility. Be confident in who you are and confident in your skills that you've worked hard to develop, but stay humble, because if you lose that humility, that's when you get distracted by money, fame, and power. They're the biggest distractors. It's not a lack of intelligence. It distracts them from focusing on the process that got them there in the first place.
Define humility in the context of what you just said. A lot of people think humility, they think of, you know, just kind of cowering down and just...
Yeah, great question. Yes, great. Humility was never self-deprecation, ever. Humility, by definition, is giving credit where credit is due. So it's something here is definitely giving away one of our secret sources here. When you train the players and the players buy into giving credit where credit is due, we reciprocate it and we start spreading it and we just play as a team so much better. So, for example, if somebody, you know, does a pick and you're like, you know, great pick there, like not just like you're awesome, that's fake. But when you find real tangible actions and you're picking that out and reinforcing that in your teammate, you just start sharing that love and everyone starts playing together. So humility is giving credit where credit is due. It's not a fake humility. I would also say humility is being a learner, always recognizing there's always something to learn.
Well, look, you got us both in a flow state right now, Doc. We appreciate it. No, seriously. This is just, I mean, fascinating stuff. And people... I don't think I have a really true appreciation for the mental aspect of a lot of things in life, but especially sports and especially on this level. You know, just to get here to this level, you have to be built. Ugh. Your mental makeup has to be a certain way as it is. And to me, you know, that means it can go either way. That could be something that you could be counterproductive with if you don't handle properly, or you can, as you mentioned, get into that flow state and be able to unlock that fullest potential. So I just appreciate Thanks. You sharing some of the work that you do, man. You do a great job, and we enjoy it. And hopefully you will join us again after we win this championship next year. We can talk about the flow state and how you got the guys there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think get everybody healthy and some of these people that we can hopefully get in the draft and the young guys. We've got a great group of young guys there that we're really high on with the Bucks. And if we can just keep developing everybody and keep helping everybody to stay on that trajectory, I just love seeing what human beings can do when we work hard on all the areas of our development. So, yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it, Chris. All right.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Greg Manning, appreciate you. Director of Mental Performance for the Milwaukee Bucks does an outstanding job. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
All right. Into our own little flow state here. Thank you, Dr. Greg Manning, who provided some tremendous insights into what it takes to get to these professional athletes. Yeah, locked in. That's a great way of putting it. Director of Mental Performance. So we love that. Now, let's move on to a subject that has hit the press recently. John Horst, who is the man responsible for assembling the Milwaukee Bucks in terms of talent, acquiring players, making trades, doing all that good stuff. There was some talk, Chris, that the Detroit Pistons, I know John is from the Detroit area, right around the Birmingham area. Yeah. They had a great hotel out that way, and that's near where he grew up. And so there was some concerns, let me put it that way, that John Horst might be looking toward Michigan to further his career. But the Bucks said, put the butts on the request to speak with him. So I like that move. I mean, John Horst has done a great job. You know, one of the best things that he has done is you know, being able to lock up Giannis and get multiple extensions for him since the time that I've been here. I like the moves that didn't maybe work out. Nikola Mirotic, he brought him in late, thinking that he would help us in terms of shooting in the playoffs. Didn't work out, but you know, you look at his numbers when he brought him in when he was playing with New Orleans, I believe, and he was shooting lights out. Just couldn't get it done here. Other moves that John has made. PJ Tucker was the key to us winning a championship.
That was nice.
You know,
that
March,
was nice.
Got him in March, and that was the key. You know, that was the key to for that championship run. And I even like, you know, I'm gonna get a lot of, you know, a lot of blowback from certain people out there. But you know, the Jrue Holiday, Dame Lillard move, I thought was necessary. And I love Jrue, and you know, but my thing is this: Jrue is great as a fourth or fifth option behind Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown and Porzingis and Derek White, you know, and now the pressure's not on him to have to produce 18 to 20 points every single night. He can just lock you down defensively. The Bucks needed a solid 1A kind of a score. And that's it. I'm not even going to say, you know, 1A, 1B, just 1 and 1A. You know, Giannis is the face of the franchise, but Dame Lillard, I think with the healthy season, a season of adjustment coming into next year, Doc Rivers, a full training camp. I like that move. So I like that move. John Horst hanging with the Bucks is a good move in my mind.
Yeah, it's a dope move, man. And it keeps that continuity going. Milwaukee, big offseason too with the draft. It's going to be interesting to see who the Bucks keep. You know, five big time free agents on the Bucks that may, you know, a couple of them may not be here. Some may be here. A lot of decisions to be made. But the continuity aspect, man, I think that's dope for the Bucks.
Yeah, like we always talk about, bringing in some youth, some young legs, some youth with experience. We got good youth. Ajax, Andre Jackson Jr., AJ Green, I mean, Chris Livingston. We got some really good young, I'll even throw Ty Washington. I've seen some glimpses of serious potential from him, watching him in practices and the sporadic minutes he gets in games. So, But experience is key. So, all right. So Doc Rivers, there's some talk. I've been reading about Doc and Sam Cassell, and man, you know,
Sam, I am.
And he's one of my favorite guys, you know, and just one of my favorite guys, you know, just because of the amount of respect. I don't care what he's doing, what team he's with, the Clippers, the Sixers, he's with the Celtics now, whoever he is, whoever he's talking to, could be Joel Embiid. He stopped. Yeah, there's this guy right here. There's a baller right here. You know, point to me, come over, give me a hug, you know. And, you know, when guys give it up like that, you're smiling. But you know what I'm talking about. When guys
gotta love Sam Cassell, dog.
You know, you love it. And the knowledge that he has gained being a longtime assistant. I don't know how many years he's been an assistant. Got to be at least dang near 10 or more. I mean, he's been around for so long. I just think he's probably ready for a head job. And if that's not going to happen for him, then I think Sam, in terms of how he relates to players and keeps, there's a clip on YouTube or somewhere, Twitter or something that I saw, he in a shooting game with James Harden, and he just talking trash. You know, just because you missed it. You know, but I don't care who you are. You know, MVP, whatever, don't matter. Sam Cassell is coming at you with the real.
Yeah, coming at you with the real, but you know, also in the NBA level or in the professional level, when you have those guys that played the game, especially those East Coast dudes, they have a way about them and the way they talk about the game. Their energy is just something that, you know, is infectious, and it really can't be duplicated. I mean, he's from that Baltimore area. Those type of dudes, man, you just love them. I think he'd be good for the Bucks from a Dame Lillard standpoint, somebody to kind of be in the middle of him and Doc. And I'm not saying in the middle as some issue, but like in the middle, being able to translate some of these things and sort of that voice that, you know, Dame's willing to, you know, I mean, I'm sure he's listening to Doc, but it just hits a little different when you got your OG telling you versus, you know, your coach. And also, even with Giannis, man, Giannis, Chris, I think his biggest value is going to be getting in the ears of the big three and, you know, getting their ear and then getting them to buy into whatever's going on at a higher rate. And I think that's going to be dope.
Yeah. And the fact that he has, you know, been with Doc with the Clippers for a number of years, has, you know, been with Doc with the Sixers. But it just dawned on me, and this kind of harkens back to something we were talking about, great two-way athletes, but the three-guard tandem at Florida State was Sam Cassell, Bobby Ward, and Charlie Ward.
Come on, Super Tuesday, ESPN.
I saw them in the preseason NIT back at the Garden. UCLA was back there around 94, and they were playing in that NIT semifinal. Man, talk about guys that could go. Sam Cassell could go. And he's a guy that we talked to Dr. Manning about, a guy that has confidence and humility, but not afraid of the big moments. Sure. Sam Cassell, he takes the big shots and will talk trash to you and do the whole onions thing that Kobe used to do. After he does it.
Big basketball,
man, for sure. And then finally, man, I gotta touch on the ladies. So Caitlin Clark, I haven't been following her that closely. I know she had 20 points and 10 turnovers her first game. Kind of got locked up a little bit. But I forget the WNBA lady who made the comment when they asked her, was she as good as she thought she was? And her comment was, I got to look this lady's name up to give her due respect. But she said, yes, Caitlin Clark was every bit as good as we thought she was, but it's just that we are better as WNBA ball players than you guys gave us credit for being. And that was one of the 100%. Things that a lot of ladies talked about coming in, that it wasn't going to be, and she's going to have some success. We want success, but the whole idea of she's going to dominate the league right off the bat, she's got a target on her back. And these ladies that have been in the league, veterans, hardened veterans, they're not having that right now.
Yeah, and the women's game, man, when you're a grown woman, the grown woman factor is a big deal in the women's game. And so when you go and you're playing against women, are just absolutely mature, strong, seasoned, and they got some little extra motivation, this whole idea of hazing and we're going to treat people differently, because they're treating Caitlin Clark differently, to make no mistake about it. They are extra physical with her. They are running her through, three, four, and five screens. They're face guarding her. So what you see is a combination of utmost respect for her game, but then there's also that extra motivation thing that every single female in the WNBA has against Caitlin. Shoot, she had 20 on Connecticut. Connecticut is like the number three team in the WNBA with like the number two defense in the WNBA. She had 10 turnovers, granted, but let's look at who else had 10 turnovers in their debut. Not a lot, right? You had Cynthia Cooper with 9. Lisa Leslie had 8. But you had high turnovers from some of the best to ever play the game. So 10 to me was not a big deal in your first game.
Well, and that's the thing that stood out to me. It's like everybody's talking about how we're her – debut was less than impressive, but she had a dub. She had 20 points. At 20 points,
4 threes.
That's the yardstick. You drop a 20 on pros. Your first game, you gonna figure it out. There's nowhere else to go but up from there. I love the women's game. I had a chance to watch a lot of great young lady ball players. I was in Des Moines, Iowa for an EYBL tournament this past weekend, watching your sister, my daughter Shiloh, play with the Sports Academy. It used to be the Mamba Academy, but now it's the Sports Academy. And man, I saw some great talent. And so I looked at the All-Iowa Attack. That was the AAU team that Caitlin played for. Talked to a referee who refereed her games back in the day. He told me she was feisty. She was trash talking. She had a lot of attitude even back then. You could tell, shooting bombs back then. You could tell, at 13, 14, she was going to be a standout player. Which brings me to the final point of this podcast. I would love to see the Milwaukee area, Fiserv Forum, host some WNBA games with the Milwaukee. Now, back when I played, we had the Milwaukee Does. You got the Bucks, you got the Does. Larry Costello, who coached the Bucks, he was the first coach of the Does, I believe, around 1970-something, 78, 79.
Oh, in the ABL? The AWL?
WBL, whatever the women's league was called at the time.
So wait, they were called the Milwaukee Does? A Does is a female deal?
Yes, Does, as in a female. We're the Bucks, get a Does, yeah. And, but then I went to a lot of games, knew a few of them, a few ladies back then, just thinking about it now, the level of competitiveness. I mean, just the fire there, and that's when it first hit me that the lady ball player is a ball player. It doesn't matter. You can put whatever label on them you want. Right. We're all ball players, and they played the game that way, and it was fun to watch them compete. Milwaukee has a great the Milwaukee area, Appleton and Oshkosh, where Halliburton is from. They've got a program called the Wisconsin Flight Elite. Got to shout them out. They busted. they gave us all we could handle. Just some great execution, right, offensively, great shooters. I mean, just, and this is like ninth graders, you know, sophomores that that we were playing against. So the ladies game is man, it's going to be sick. In about 5 years, you can see where it's kind of headed right now, Chris. It's going to be like off the charts, I believe.
Yeah, with expansion, you know, the WNBA is adding more teams. The popularity of the game is at an all-time high. People like Juju Watkins are bringing out A-list type celebrities showing up every day. I went to about 8 USC games this year. It was a doggone show. And then this expansion thing. So if Milwaukee gets another team, that just adds to the league. I know Toronto is getting a team. San Francisco just added the Valkyries. So it's like, man, it's at an all-time high to be hooping on that side of things. And you just love to see it, how it's being embraced on a national and mainstream level. I think that's the biggest lesson that we see out of all of this, is just now everything is mainstream. So now we got, you know, we're going to have a lot of fun with it.
Well, and to your point too, and it kind of shows the level of talent, is that a Caitlin Clark just can't hit the ground running and then score 35, 40 points and just, you know, be this phenomenon that just comes right out of the chute, dominated. She's got to find her way. So that tells you that the caliber of competition in that league is outstanding, and it's going to be fun to watch and see where it goes from here. So, man, that's it. That's all. Man, what a great conversation, great guest, and Dr. Craig Manning, yep, and what he brought to the table. And talking, yep, about these ladies got me all fired up, because my daughter Shiloh is still kind of feeling her way around in terms of the emotions of the game and everything, but it's all
going to be okay.
It's a fantastic voyage, man. It's a fantastic voyage. I'm the captain of this vessel. This is my first mate, Chris Johnson, Marcus Johnson. We'll be back next week to hear District. Check us out wherever you get your podcast from.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.